July 19, 2009. South Park, Seattle. Neighbors rush from their homes toward screams and breaking glass, finding two naked women in the street, one dying, one standing in absolute terror. A chilling whisper spreads through the crowd. Isaiah. This wasn't random violence. This was the predictable endpoint of a system designed to fail, where a young man's descent into psychosis was met with bureaucratic shrugs and budget cuts. Three lives, Teresa Butts, Jennifer Hopper, and Isaiah Kalebu, were on a collision course, pulled together by forces far larger than any of them. What happened that night was horrific. What's more horrific? It didn't have to happen at all. Teresa Butts grew up as the ninth of 11 kids in a boisterous Irish-German Catholic family in St. Louis. Short and bulldog tough, she had a laugh that started like a chipmunk giggle and ended in full-body convulsions. Popular enough to be class president, she never dated boys, maintaining what seemed like a performative crush while struggling with a truth she couldn't yet speak. After prom with her brother, she cried, "I'll never have anybody." Jennifer Hopper was born in hiding to parents on the run. Raised in Seattle by her grandparents while her mother cycled through abusive boyfriends and painkiller addiction, Jennifer found refuge in theater. She had a voice teachers called pure, a legitimate soprano with perfect pitch. But anxiety plagued her and her body type didn't match Broadway's ingenue expectations. Their paths wound separately for years. Teresa worked cruise ships to Alaska, struggling with her sexuality and a faith that called it sin. Jennifer fled to Boston Conservatory, then New York, then back to Seattle. Then came July 31st, 2007. After hours of conversation over drinks, Teresa confessed to being a Republican Bush voter with a DUI before saying, "I really want to kiss you." Jennifer later described that kiss as different from anything before. "I felt at home." 2 years later, they were engaged, living in Teresa's small red house in South Park. While Teresa and Jennifer built their life together, Isaiah Kalebo was unraveling. Born to a Ugandan immigrant father and American mother, his childhood was marked by domestic violence and neglect, including a cigarette burn near his eye as an infant. At 17, a social worker noted he had endured a great deal of the father's abusive behavior and would benefit from mental health counseling. That recommendation went nowhere. By 16, the state had investigated the burn, watched teachers intervene, and responded to domestic violence calls. None led to help. After his parents' divorce, home foreclosure, and the discovery that colorblindness had ended his pilot dreams, Isaiah cycled through 20 jobs in 2 years. He smoked marijuana to quiet the voices in his head. Then the delusions arrived. He paced for hours, speaking in pressured bursts no one could follow. He called himself God, the King, President of the United States. His mother watched helplessly as her son disappeared into psychosis. "I kept trying to get him into mental hospitals, but he wouldn't go," she explained, "and he was bigger than me." Being over 18, Isaiah would legally need to seek help himself, unless he posed an immediate threat. Her words were prophetic. "I told them, do you want him to hurt someone before you help him? And that's exactly what happened." Most people don't understand mental health care in America. We dismantled the old system without building the new one. In 1955, over 500,000 Americans lived in mental hospitals. President Kennedy's 1963 Community Mental Health Act promised community-based treatment. Mental hospital populations plummeted, accelerated by a 1975 Supreme Court ruling prohibiting involuntary commitment except for imminent danger. By 1994, roughly 92% of those who would have been institutionalized weren't. The promised federal funding never materialized. The burden fell on unprepared families, then police, emergency rooms, courts, and prisons, the new asylums without therapeutic intent. When police brought Isaiah to Harborview Medical Center after he threatened his family with a knife, he actively tried to present himself as sane. despite his family's pleas and the psychiatrist noting his behavior strongly suggests he is not capable of being in behavioral control due to his mania, he didn't meet Washington's criteria for involuntary commitment. He was released without medication, prescription, or follow-up. Days later, Isaiah attacked his mother with a dog chain. "He had no idea who I was," she said. He went to jail, not treatment. At Western State Hospital, he was forcibly medicated not to heal, but to meet the minimum legal standard of competency. After his August 2008 release, Isaiah was supposed to attend appointments at Cascade Mental Health Care, a chronically underfunded clinic. He went once in September, giving terse answers, then missed 3 consecutive months. No one followed up. Washington State's $9 billion recession shortfall led to $24 million in mental health cuts, eliminating 60 hospital beds. The National Alliance on Mental Illness described a system in crisis, creating a vicious cycle that destroys lives. Isaiah made one final appearance at Cascade in January 2009, arguing about his medications. The clinician lowered his dose without checking blood levels, noting that stopping medication would be a disaster. Isaiah never returned. When his aunt sought a restraining order, calling herself a prisoner in my own home, his last meaningful attachment was severed. The next day, his aunt and her partner died in an arson. Detectives questioned Isaiah, who appeared strangely calm watching the burned house. With nowhere to go, Isaiah wandered homeless with his dog and his delusions until he encountered Teresa and Jennifer sleeping in their South Park home. Teresa died. Jennifer survived, but was forever changed. Nearly 2 years later, Isaiah testified in a yellow shirt, his request for a judge's robe denied. "I was there, and I was told by my God and the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob to attack my enemies. I did so. I followed the instructions by God." The jury found him guilty on all counts. Judge Hayden sentenced him to life without parole plus 2 additional life sentences. Isaiah's incarceration will cost Washington State over $1.85 million if he lives to 73. Adding jail costs, psychiatric evaluations, prosecution, defense, and appeals, the public bill exceeds $3 million. Isaiah could have received weekly counseling from childhood through adulthood for a fraction of that cost. Mental health advocates call this an absurd misallocation of resources. Laws like New York's Kendra's Law allow court-ordered outpatient commitment for adults with mental illness who have histories of treatment noncompliance. Isaiah's case would have been a slam dunk for such intervention. America now houses 10 times more mentally ill people in jails, 350,000, than in psychiatric hospitals, 35,000. Between 2009 and 2012, states cut $4.35 billion from mental health budgets. We've built a system that waits for tragedy, then punishes it, instead of preventing it. 3 years after the trial, Jennifer spoke at a Seattle Police Department retreat. When asked about forgiveness, she explained that seeing Isaiah with his mother changed everything. He was somebody's child. Forgiveness meant restoring what there was before, returning to being strangers who would wish each other well. "It has nothing to do with him. It has everything to do with me. He can no longer diminish me," inside of forgiveness. Teresa's brother Norbert credits her as his spiritual sponsor, who helped him find sobriety. He created the Angel Band Project, a nonprofit using music therapy to help survivors of sexual violence. Jennifer now lives with her mother, Marcia, who's been sober for years. Her mother's transformation inspires her. If she can do this and she can be strong enough to share it and was actually in the moment and seen all this and seen her love die, I can do it. At dusk on the Duwamish River, despite pollution, nature persists. Salmon jump, harbor seals surface, herons wade. Conservationists have hung gourd-shaped nests on old pilings to attract purple martins that once roosted there. Gradually, the birds are returning, a small sign of healing in a landscape of loss. This is resilience, not forgetting, not excusing, but choosing to believe something better remains possible. Teresa and Jennifer found home in each other. Isaiah never found home at all. A system that should have caught him let him fall, taking Teresa with him. We can't bring her back. but we can decide whether the next Isaiah gets help before it's too late. The Purple Martins are returning. The question is, will we?